Hello, I'm Clive Barnett.
And I'm Margot Huxley.
Margot and I are going to talk about the relevance of the critical spatial thinking framework. The first topic we're going to talk about is the issue of placemaking. You've already learnt that particular places generate their own distinctive issues, but also that those issues are in part shaped by the connections that places have with each other. So, Margot, I wonder if you could perhaps talk about some examples you're aware of places which are associated with very distinctive issues which reveal some interesting spatial connections.
Well, I think I'll start with an example of, as you can hear, I'm Australian, when I first came to Sheffield, because that threw up lots of interesting examples of how it was different and yet similar to where I'd come from in Melbourne. Sheffield, of course, had been a centre of steelmaking and had suffered great decline. But just walking around Sheffield and talking to people, one of the issues that I noticed was that everyone seemed to hate the shopping centre Meadowhall, which was out on the fringes of the town, and saw it as a cause of the decline of the shopping area in the centre of town. But to an Australian, Meadowhall is amazing because it's connected by train, by bus, by tram and by road to all the places around. And instead of having a sort of freestanding shopping mall in the middle of nowhere accessible only by car, as you get in Australia. So we have their shopping malls that are sort of seen to be almost universal across, well, at least advanced Western society. But it takes on a particular cast in Sheffield and becomes a local issue. I think the city centre was probably declining anyway, and it had a very difficult physical form, a long spread out physical form that made it hard for the planners to deal with when shops were closing. But to me, that showed the links between sort of large-scale economic change, something that looks quite similar across different places, but raise a lot of local issues in a particular way.
Sheffield, I guess, is a place which probably hasn't been the source of a great deal of theorising about urban development or planning issues. From your experience, which, as you've indicated, comes from various contexts, I wonder if you have a sense of why certain places might become exemplary, might generate classic models of how to do things or how things are done?
That's an interesting question. I think Jenny Robinson's idea of ordinary city points us to the idea that in fact a lot of the things that theory might point out as being very important in making a place unique, such as the City of London being a centre of finance or New York being, you know, sort of everyone's idea of the city of cities, actually, when you get down into the nitty-gritty, are not so very different from ordinary cities that are also having investment and disinvestment and creative destruction. But one of the things that happens is that because these major cities play a role in major economies, in the global economy, they become models that people who are planners or politicians want to emulate. And so they are seen to be, I think, more unique than they may actually be.
The second topic we want to talk about is thinking a little bit more about the framework of critical spatial thinking. You'll recall that framework suggests that there's three types of questions or three types of problems that different traditions of urban thinking and spatial thinking direct you to. So the framework is really meant as an orientation device for you rather than as a template to apply. Those three types of questions are, first of all, causal ones. You can ask a series of questions about how and why particular events or particular issues have come to take place in particular contexts. Secondly, there's a set of questions about the cultural, if you like, dynamics through which issues become recognised as important and as relevant to particular places and the people who live in them. And thirdly, there's a series of issues about who and what scale action should be taken to address issues. So those three broad questions are the framework that you've been introduced to. What we want to do is to try and give you a sense of how you might make use of those different questions in the context in which you're familiar with. So I'm going to ask Margot, first of all, Margot, if you can talk a little bit about the ways in which those three aspects of the framework might apply to the place you've been talking about already, Sheffield.
Yes, we can apply this to everywhere in certain ways. I'm picking Sheffield because I have been living there long enough to have noticed these things. I could have done Melbourne. So looking at the causal level of what's going on in Sheffield, of course, immediately we have the loss of the steel industry, and before that, creative destruction of the Second World War, which allowed a lot of redevelopment to take place. So there's a history in the built environment there that you can see, and that can be read as part of Sheffield networking into a globalised economy and the changing nature of that economy. There's also then, because of that and because of the Sheffield being the place that it is, there's a whole set of networks, both physical in terms of the type of place it is with hills and valleys and the kind of buildings that are able to be built there, networks of politics between the unions, the Labour Party, the council and various other bodies, which make Sheffield what it is. So we have those networks of how decisions might be taken because of who is talking to who and who has power and who doesn't, and the changing nature of that. And thirdly, then we have the kinds of actions that we could take. And I would like to relate that to the idea that some of the policies that get put in place see action as having to be on a large scale, that we have to revive and regenerate Sheffield by lots of building, lots of funky new shops, lots of places for people to go, and try to encourage large-scale industrial investment to come back. And that tends to overlook small-scale actions. And I'm associated with a group of people who are trying to buy collectively a small late 19th century building called Portland Works, which was one of the few buildings still left that has traditional Sheffield cutlery and small metal fabrication in it. And so our actions are trying to, in effect, propose different futures to, say, some of the more large-scale ideas that some of the planners have. So there's different levels of action there as well.
So it sounds like in that example that rather than there being three distinct analytical strands of the causal, the cultural and the communicative and agency, that all three are kind of wrapped up, and to really understand what's going on around that particular campaign in that particular place, we'd have to combine the three in different ways.
Yes, and certainly, and indeed the whole idea of the assemblage of a network of things and people because of the actual nature of the building in Portland Works is very much why it's been able to have people carrying out the work that they do in it. And it is also part of the historical fabric of Sheffield. And so that becomes part of the things that are assembled in the attempt to preserve not just the building, but the kinds of things that go on in there. Whereas there tends to be a view in among many planners that in order to regenerate, you have to pull everything down and start with a blank slate. And so you start with a whole set of different networks and different ideas and different politics and different economics.
Can I ask a further question about your example? I wonder whether or not the campaign you've been describing has drawn on experiences of other places, or indeed whether or not other places are now more and more interested in your campaign as something that they can...
That's interesting. We did quite a bit of research on other collective and communal cooperative ways of buying buildings. There weren't many that were about an industrial building. There were quite a few farms and housing associations and so on. So we set up something called an Industrial Providence Society, which sounds beautifully Victorian. But there are examples. There are examples in Sydney. We looked at an example of a works that had existing industries in it. The thing about Portland Works is that it does have artists in it. Many of these old buildings get set up as artists' studios. And as David Harvey and Neil Smith have said, that then starts off gentrification. But we're trying to keep it with the traditional mixture of traditional and new things, and there aren't many initiatives like that that we've come across. So we're hoping, because we have a website and we do lots of publicity, we're hoping perhaps if we're successful in our campaign, it might become something that other people could gather ideas for alternative ways of doing things from.
That kind of draws us on, I think, to the third topic we want to touch upon, which is the use of the kind of a theoretical imagination can have in practice for professional decision makers or for campaigners and other people. I wonder if you've been involved for some time in debates about the importance of normative thinking, as it were, in planning theory and in spatial thinking. And I wonder if, from your experience, you could say a little bit about what the practical relevance of a conceptual imagination is and what we can learn theoretically from people's practical experiences as well.
Yes, it's a question that always used to come up when I was teaching in planning courses in Australia. Yes, but what's it got to do with planning? And I think you could say that almost everything's got something to do with planning. The theoretical framework that I looked at most in terms of planning theory is that of participatory planning, communicative and collaborative planning, which at the level of the academic work is very inspiring. It's wanting to make sure that planners don't go riding roughshod over people's desires about how to make their own places, and that they do involve everybody and talk to them as much as possible and take on board their ideas. But I have found in practice that, in fact, it's very difficult to do that. If you're working for a local government or even a private consultant, you have to meet the next deadline. You have to deal with what the politicians want or what your client wants. You can't always carry out the kinds of processes that the theoretical framework suggests would be ideal. And so on the ground, you really have to think on your feet about how can we make this work without alienating people, and particularly, I think, not allowing people to get the idea that, I think the idea is that it is consultation and not participation. Because planners, by and large, are bureaucrats working for the state, if it's participation, they're kind of bypassing the political, as it were. So I think there are a lot of issues there where actually working in practice should feed back more into making the theory slightly more in touch with reality.
Listening to you, it seems to me that what you've done is precisely that. You've actually made some interesting conceptual distinctions. For example, making it clear that planners or professionals or decision makers might be more appropriately thought of as consulting rather than participating. And that sort of distinction is what we'd think of as an important theoretical point to make sure that we can recognise what it is that's going on under certain descriptions.
Yes, and not call it by names that might set up false assumptions about what can or can't be achieved through these kinds of processes. That's not to deny that action through community activism and protest groups can't change things. Of course they can, and the planners can and should take on board people's ideas. But I think planners also have to realise that they are not partisan members of those community groups, but neither should they be sort of party political. I mean, this sounds very old-fashioned. A lot of the communicative planning theory tries to get away from this. But I think there's something to be said, as theoretically Weber did, that there is something to be said about being a bit standing back a bit from the fray and trying to see where your position is in relation to the issue.
It's interesting. This is perhaps a hard question to ask you, but I'll ask it anyway. Because the example you've talked about in Sheffield, but also your general point about planning theory and consultation versus participation, those are all examples in which decision-making about spatial practices are clearly about conflict and different interests. Yet on the other hand, planning theory and spatial theory in general has generated lots of interesting kind of normative models of the just city and of spatial justice and of the right to the city. And it strikes me that there's an interesting tension between those discourses which seem to be telling professional thinkers of different ways of their normative roles versus the sort of the sense of the slightly more conflictual and difficult nature of doing things in practice. I wonder if you have a thought of why it is that those fields of professional practice and academic work have been so concerned with thinking through their normative responsibilities.
And I think there are two things there. One is that we can talk about processes of urbanisation and the powers that create the kinds of spaces and the divisions and the inequalities in urban space and access to resources and services. So at one level, a lot of those theories are thinking quite broadly about how space comes to be made. And so there are normative, broadly philosophical normative issues raised there. Then there is the professional ethics that get taught to people who are going to be planners or architects. And there is a tension there between your ethical obligations to your boss or your organisation against the theories about the state that may say that the state is the object of protest. So inevitably, I think professionals are walking a tightrope, particularly if they're working for the state, about what are the ethics of what they can do. Should they leak secret deals or and risk being sacked? Or, I mean, how do you deal with those kind of ethical problems, which are at a much finer grain level than looking at the right to the city in terms of social movements or homelessness in the philosophical sense?
Perhaps leading on from that, one final point for us to think about is, on the one hand, there's those very grand debates about justice and the just city and the right to the city, but it's also clear that various fields of spatial practice, planning and environmental management and others in the last decade or so have become focused on very particular sets of topics like sustainability and resilience, adaptation, transition, topics like that, which sort of seem to also have kind of a normative inflection to them, but also interestingly more modest. Just kind of being resilient or just adapting is a much less ambitious hope than instantiating social justice, isn't it? I wonder if you have any thoughts about why those sorts of topics have become so important as grand discourses in particular fields.
I think that's very interesting. I think there's, it's, again, several strands to that. As we're saying, they're all mixed together. On the one hand, there's an attempt to provide alternatives to what has been for the last 30 or 40 years major thinking in terms of urban policy about regeneration, about, as I was saying before, bringing in mega investment in housing or offices or whatever, which has become obviously now beginning to be criticised and seen to be not necessarily the way to go. So it's a posing of alternatives to some of the mainstream policies I see as being some of the advantages of this. And it's also seeing that a lot of what we need to deal with in terms of the environment and future resilience relies on people actions in their own places rather than necessarily major changes overall. Although, of course, we might like to see some change in, for instance, investment banking. But so there's several reasons why that might be. And the thing that really interests me is that I think the people who are charged with policy and decision-making, be it environmental or urban, need to take notice of those small changes, need to be aware of transition towns and resilience and also even make it easier to recycle rubbish. Because those are the things that often slip underneath the radar, like Portland Works, that they are doing things that can offer an alternative way of looking at the present and the future, and often need to be supported and often aren't.
I actually have one final question I'm going to ask you, Margot, and it's about the idea that particular spatial practices, planning, urban and regional planning, are often characterised by distinctive spatial rationales, the causal rationales. They have particular understandings of how the design or form of space causes certain sorts of outcomes. So I wonder if you think that that idea of a concept you developed in relation to the history of planning practice is also something one might apply if one wanted to understand the emergence of debates and discourses about sustainability or resilience and so on.
Yeah, I think there are two aspects to that. There certainly have been in planning thinking and in urban attempts at urban reform this idea that if you make nice places, you will get nice people. but of course, as we say, you can't, just because you design an environment to produce an outcome, it doesn't mean that it will. You can make a beautiful environment and people will not necessarily do as they're expected to in it, as we always have fights about antisocial behaviour. But nevertheless, it's not the case as once perhaps more Marxist thinking in the 70s implied that space didn't make any difference at all and it was just a blank sheet that capitalism formed in its own image. Spaces do make a difference, and the smaller scale changes such as sustainability and resilience are very important, but they're not necessarily quite so moralistic as saying we can make a good society by building good buildings, but it is saying that we can make a better form of city by smaller changes, which should be supported. I mean, even down to the expensive problem of solar panels, which aren't getting the support they might otherwise. And of course, there are debates about whether wind turbines are good or not. But the small scale, I think, is important in terms of enabling people to walk to the shops. You can't guarantee they will, but they certainly can't if they're not there. So, yes, I think there's a midway between total environmental determinism and saying space doesn't matter at all.
Thank you, Margie. That's a great point to end on. I think you've given us a sense of the opportunities and the limitations of acting locally and how far that depends on the places you might be connected to.
Thank you.